Morning.
Okay, so it looks like everybody's here from staff. And for next meeting, we're going to add Peter to the actual committee. He wasn't added this time, he will be added next time. Need a motion for approval of minutes?
Make a motion.
Second. All in favor? All against? Okay, passes. All right, we're going to kick it right off with Sykes, with Kim. Jump right into it.
Hi, I'm Kim Mikely, and I'm a Sykes Investment Advisor. And I'm going to speak to you first a little bit about the economic overview, and then go into a little bit of detail about the third quarter as to the portfolio that we manage for you. Just kind of taking a broader perspective of where we've started the year and where we are now. The consensus at the beginning of 2017 was more of a reflation trade based upon the Trump agenda. So we were thinking, not we, but the consensus was that the expectation was that you would see longer-term rates rise, that the yield curve would actually steepen, and monetary focus would then transfer over to more of a fiscal policy focus. We anticipated to have great progress with tax reform, Obama's repeal and replace, infrastructure spending, and with that, with the rise in interest rates, there was the thought that there would be more volatility in the marketplace and that the dollar would strengthen. As they say, consensus many times is wrong, and all of those thoughts at the beginning of the year have not occurred. So at this point in time, you can see here that the 10-year has actually declined year-to-date by 11 basis points, the 30-year by 20. Certainly, we have seen an increase in the short end of the curve, and that has resulted not in a steepening, but a flattening of the yield curve. Just looking at the third quarter, we saw a little bit of a moderate flattening of the yield curve, and that the 10-year increased about 3 basis points, and the 2-year by 10. And so that was just a little bit of flattening, if you will, for the third quarter. However, September, if you look month by month at returns, September was a little bit difficult in the fact that the 10-year started at a 2.30 in June and went to a low of about a 2.04 in early September, and then a retracement back to the 2.33. So you had about 29 basis points of retracement or rise in interest rates. And as you know, with the increase in rates, you get a decline in price. So of the 3 months, September, for longer-term portfolios, you saw a little bit of a negative return. The other thing to look at is corporate spreads. And we've been monitoring this and showing this for many, many quarters. Corporate spreads continue to tighten. We started the second quarter, went from a 118 to a 109. This third quarter from a 109 to 101. And then as we've progressed into the fourth quarter, we're now in areas of 94 to 95 based on whatever day that we're looking at. So a lot of compression as to corporate spreads. And the value of corporates when they tighten increases, results in excess return. And so if you look, essentially there's been a insatiable need for yield, and all the investment grades such as corporates, securitized, even government agencies, high yield, have all performed well in this environment because of spread compression. As it relates to volatility, as the consensus was that we would see higher volatility, we in fact have seen much lower volatility as the year has progressed. If you look on the equity side, there's an index called the VIX, which has hit lows. And on the fixed income side is the MOVE Index, and that has dropped below 50. And to give you kind of like a perspective, on the fixed income side, the MOVE Index, the high in 2008 was 208, and here we are at 45. So a great deal of less volatility in the marketplace, if you will. And in light of what we have seen, North Korea with missile launches, Catalonia, there's all these various exogenous events taking place, and the markets really aren't reacting as one would have seen in the past. There's just so much need for yield. It's kept volatility low, if you will. Looking at growth, GDP. Second quarter GDP came in at 3.1%, and the first quarter's came in at 1.2. So if you look at the first half of 2017 growth rate, that was at 2.15%. on an annualized basis. And essentially, that's been the growth rate that we have seen since July of 2009. So we're kind of still bubbling along as we have been. Certainly, you saw a strong number of 3.1%, and we've got the third quarter GDP number that came out at 3% for the third quarter. That number will see some revisions to it. And if there is any weakness, certainly some of that would be attributed to hurricane events, etc. We, however, think, though, that if you look at that third quarter GDP number, it was inventory accumulation and trade. And essentially, as far as like the organic growth in the economy, it's not there as far as consistently. I mean, we're seeing two quarters worth, but we really are not anticipating that to continue quarter by quarter by quarter. As it relates to the Fed certainly has been in the spotlight, and right now, you had in the third quarter, the Fed announced their normalization process, and it's certainly taken place starting with October. And essentially, the Fed's balance sheet has gone from $800 billion to $4.5 trillion. They've been purchasing treasuries and mortgages in the marketplace. And that was a result of the aftermath of the financial crisis. So with that normalization process, they're looking to reduce that gradually, starting with $10 billion a month for the first quarter. So you're looking at less reinvestment of interest and mortgage prepayments month by month. So there'll be $6 billion of treasury, $4 billion mortgages that will roll off in month by month in the fourth quarter. Come January, it'll increase by $10 billion quarter by quarter. So January would be 20, that $10 billion of treasury, $8 billion of mortgages. And then by October 2018, the plan would be to cap out at $50 billion a month. And that's certainly what has been a starting point, and the question will be, if we're at $4.5 trillion, what will the target balance be for the Fed? Is that $2.5 trillion? We don't know. Now, we're in a little bit of uncharted territory as to that effect. Someone said that by doing this, it acts a little bit as like a rate increase as well. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out and how they follow the plan that was conveyed.
Did they announce or recall any, what did they say, what would retract from that plan? Like, if they're, you know, what would make that plan not be followed through, like what changes in the marketplace or?
I think if you see some volatility pick up, or perhaps if we saw some exogenous event take place, there could be outside.
Like issuances, because, you know, if you're not buying and reinvesting, then you can't issue, I mean, who, why, I mean, issuance.
Well, the market, I mean, market, or they are purchasing. The thing is the Fed has been buying, particularly on the mortgage side, those securities, which has caused the residential mortgage-backed security market to be a little bit overvalued. So, you know, if you have, if that buyer isn't there, there'll be others who may step in. And certainly, if you see the value decline, then there'll be natural buyers coming in to take advantage of that.
I just wonder if there'll be natural buyers to the tune of $50 billion a month.
Well, you have to mind that there's foreign buyers as well. Right. I mean, their market, their rates are quite low.
Right. And some are
attractive. Right. And there will be.
What a great plan.
Money will flow to where you're benefited the most.
Right.
So, you know, it will. It's just supply and demand.
Financial range wonders how that's all going to go down.
Yeah. Secondly, the Fed is likely to raise rates again in December. The probability is 92%. Certainly, Yellen and her other Fed officials have kind of conveyed that to the marketplace. And then thirdly, you have Trump, who has made his selection as the Fed chair nomination, and that is Jerome Powell. And, you know, he's on the Board of Governors now, and he was a little bit of a dark horse, if you will, when people were evaluating the various players up for that. But we were thinking that he very well, if he had, could be the one chosen. And in fact, he was. And it may be a little bit of the same, if you will. He's not been one to go against Yellen in the past from a voting perspective. And if you look at the makeup of the board, there are three, potentially four openings. Yellen's term expires February 2018. The question will be as to whether she will just walk away. She still does have a term to her board governor position. Most times they walk away, but there has been one Eccles who actually stayed on. So it'll be interesting to see what she decides to do. But there are places to fill within the board that could in fact have an effect upon the dot plots will for 2018. Right now, the thought is that there'll be three rate increases, but as you get these new players coming in, potential retirement, I think of Dudley now. So you've got a lot of transition taking place within the Fed. So it's kind of hard to comment at that point in time as to, you know, with what we're going through with the normalization process and people, how that dot plot will.
Whether the players change, does the plan change?
Right. And then, as we were talking about the agenda items, you have healthcare reform and infrastructure spending. We feel that that's really not going to be on the docket at this point until fiscal year 2019 after elections. And right now, you've got tax reform in front of us. And as we've stated with other legislation, that the devil's in the detail. And there's going to be a lot of heavy negotiation that will have to take place for this to kind of cross the finish line. And the question will be, how much growth are you going to get from this tax reform? And that's going to be the critical factor, because we all want growth in the economy. And that's the whole premise of this tax reform. The one area where we have seen Trump make some strides has been with regards to regulation. There is a federal register, and it's a document where all federal regulations are published, and it serves as kind of a proxy for regulation. And over the last 7 months in Trump's term, that regulation document has been cut by a third. So that just shows you that regulation as a whole has been improved as far as and taken away, and certainly bodes well for small business. There's an index called the National Federation of Independent Business Optimism, and that hit a high post-Trump election and has remained quite high throughout this year. And certainly that's a result of less regulation, because that helps with small business formation and growth, which at the end of the day, when you look at what makes up growth in the economy, much of that comes from the small business sector. And so that's where you're going to get the organic growth that we're looking for that would be sustainable. So at this point in time, we feel that the argument we can't make an argument right now as to a reflation trade. It didn't occur at the beginning of the year. We don't think that we're there now. And we see that U.S. growth continues to be in that 1.5% to 2% area. And to achieve 3% to 4% growth will take a monumental effort, if you will. And we don't really see that right now at this point. If you turn here to page 3, we have the performance for the quarter, and third quarter's performance was 0.62 versus the index at 0.7, and that is the Merrill Lynch Domestic Master one to 10 years. So we are a longer term benchmark, if you will, compared to your other managers. Some of the positive contributors to performance were more security selection within our corporate sleeve, as well as our asset allocation to asset-backed securities, which is not part of the index, as well as commercial mortgage-backed securities. We had an underweight in corporates and an underweight in residential mortgage-backed securities. As we talked about, we saw spreads tightening. We've been de-risking the portfolio throughout the year, as indicated in the year-to-date numbers and reflected also in the fiscal year-to-date numbers. We are where we are trailing the benchmark. One thing that I did was, given the fact that we have de-risked and put more emphasis in higher quality and treasury securities, I thought it would be helpful right now just for you to see an A-rated or better index, and you can see that we are a little bit more in line with that at this juncture, 0.62 versus the index at 0.62 if it's an A-rated or better. Year-to-date, a 2 of 3, a little bit more in line, fiscal year to date, minus 3 basis points. This A-rated or better index certainly does not serve the purpose when you go out past the 5-year mark, because we were managing to like a 1 to 5 benchmark, so that's a longer term index and is not reflective. Another thing to kind of keep in mind as it relates to our current benchmark, which is the regular B of A 1 to 10 year domestic master, is that that index encompasses all of triple B rated securities, and we are restricted to mid triple B. And as we've talked about, lower quality, higher beta names have done quite well. So that lower BAA3, even the crossovers, which we typically would invest in, have done well and is reflected in that 0.7 return number. Just to give you an idea, that BAA free sleeve earned a return of 0.4 for that quarter, and it is about 17 basis points in the year-to-date number. So it's a little bit, you know, meaningful, if you will. So I just wanted to kind of give that to you as a little bit of perspective, given how we have taken some risk off the table. The market value at the end of September was $56.5 million. It increased about $350,000. Our duration, we're about 4.2 versus the index at 4.1. Our yield's a little bit less than the benchmark of 2.16 versus 2.29 because of that higher quality, a little bit more emphasis in the treasury sector. And the quality is AA rated. We did reduce, and I'd like to focus a little bit more on this contribution to the duration area here, and the fact that we are at about 0.7 times the index. If you look at the corporate sector, we did reduce our industrials. Again, we did some of that even in the second quarter. One thing that we've seen is the industrial sector has done quite well over the last 12 to 18 months, and certainly have been using that opportunity to sell and take some gains there. And then if you look at the securitized side, we're equal weight here, but from a duration perspective, the residential mortgage-backed sector is about 0.7 times as well. We're using CMBS and ABS, certainly as a substitute to our void and government related. We like that particular sector and the fact that it is high quality, and the payment streams for those securities that we invest in are very transparent, and we feel comfortable with those. So just wanted to give you a makeup of where we're at, and we just feel that there's a little bit of complacency in the market, and think that if there's any bubble there, it would be from a complacency standpoint. And then the last page, we have a compliance monitor. We have followed all the guidelines for the third quarter, and we are in compliance. There was one error under current. There's the portfolio effective duration. That number should be 4.2. Yes, and the number was picked up incorrectly in the publication of it, and I missed it. So just wanted to point that out for you. Are there any questions as it relates to our strategy and outlook? Certainly, we've taken a little bit of a de-risking perspective on the portfolio at this point in time.
Any questions? That looks pretty consistent.
Are you going to see any further de-risking? You seem to be doing that for a little bit. Or we can be?
Well, we're at, you know, one of the markers for us to do some more for this third quarter was if the OIS went below 100, and we've certainly done that and used opportunity again. So I think if we go even further, there is potential, because you have to look at it in terms of risk reward.
Yeah.
And are you getting paid for the risk that you're taking?
Yeah, right.
Motion to approve the
sector report.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All against? Okay. Next up is Solid Brass with David Siegel.
Oh, okay.
All right. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Much of what I would talk about. Kim already touched on, you know, great job on the economic overview and so forth. So I'll try to get into a little bit of what our viewpoint is based on a lot of the same key points. And as always, most importantly, how it really impacts your portfolio as well.
Okay, I need to jump ahead, but... So just a couple key points. This somewhat summarizes, I guess, what we're looking at in terms of both domestic macro environment, as well as I'll touch on some global points as well, and again, how that pertains to our market and your portfolio as a whole. So some of the things we've touched on already, you know, synchronized global growth, not just the U.S., but how are things happening in the world, especially how it pertains to their economic development and their own government markets, and how does that impact the U.S. markets. Inflation, one of the things that we talked about really ad nauseum, and especially with the new Fed, you know, Fed chair coming in and new Fed governors, how does the Fed approach that? Why is the inflation not necessarily picking up in the economy? What does that mean? Some of the monetary policies, deregulation, as Kim had touched on, the with the new Fed chair coming in, it's been mentioned a lot that some of it is status quo compared to what we had with Yellen. You know, what's the reason for that? The one big difference probably that you read about between what Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell believe in, so forth, is the deregulation factor. And we think, especially with President Trump, he's been harping on deregulation for quite some time. So that's something for him to somewhat hang his hat on, where, you know, some of the main differences may be. So how would that affect the economy as a whole? And just some other things to mention, the hurricanes and how that's going to affect the economy. Some of the GDP numbers that have come in have been quite positive. Some of that is some of the bounce back from the hurricane recovery. Essentially, normally you have somewhat of a short-term hiccup, but as you rebuild, as these areas rebuild, you see some investments in spending, which actually helps out the GDP numbers over the long run, and tax cuts, which we'll certainly get into a little bit as well. One thing we've started to do now, I think we're gonna probably do going forward, is really include some slides of economic data, just some static slides to really touch on quarter over quarter to see how things change. It's a lot of information there, but I think it's very informational for you to, you know, even on your own time, if you want to go back and just, you know, look at some of these slides and see how things have, how they've changed over time and hopefully, you know, over each quarter and how things will change going forward. So, you know, basically from a very top level look down, how's the economy doing? We've touched on this for a long time now, but it's doing well. The unemployment rate continues to come down. GDP is chugging along. It's been somewhat, you know, stuck in a range-bound type of growth for quite some time now, but it's positive growth. There is a chance that that picks up as well. But again, it is chugging along quarter over quarter, year over year, with, you know, mild economic growth. Housing continues to pick up, and retail sales is just somewhat of a proxy of overall both consumer confidence and economic growth.
I have a question as it relates to some of the economic data. Through the hurricanes that happened, I mean, with Harvey, Maria, I mean, some of them were pretty devastating. The mortgage companies, you know, under federal guidelines, you can take that 90-day no pay of a mortgage. So I'm assuming we'll see that in some of their earnings, because you had massive amounts of people that would affect. From a retail sales standpoint, are we forecasting declines in certain types of purchases, like building supplies may be up, obviously, because you have to rebuild entire cities and communities and flood out. But from an unemployment rate standpoint, businesses are also destroyed, small businesses mostly destroyed, so that affects employment. You know, I imagine there will be some underemployment as a result of that, so you may be employed, but your job got destroyed, so now you're, you know, more so in Puerto Rico, there's 3 million people affected on the island. A lot of them here, South Florida cities, Orlando, Tampa, and Miami are going to be taking those kids in to schools. So I'm just wondering, like, do we have any projections of what realistically some of that would be? I mean, the kids even are still getting it all back.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's going to have an impact for sure. And even the most recent jobs number that came out was a good number. However, it was under what the consensus was going to be. And the participation rate actually ticked down, which means that some people left the job force. And a lot of that could be attributed to people in different areas, Houston, Puerto Rico, and Florida especially, kind of taking a step back at this point and, you know, worrying about the rebuilding process. So, yes, it'll certainly, there are numbers that are out.
We had the forecast for Black Friday not being maybe as strong because you know, if you don't have a house, you're not going to buy a good iPad.
Yeah. It doesn't seem as if the impact is supposed to be that strong, really. I mean, and some of it is not to discount the impact it's had on Florida or Houston or Puerto Rico. But from a niche, I think it would be more, you know, regional as far as how those impacts are going to go. It could affect retail sales, but like you said, that's going to be somewhat counter.
Yeah. Well, actually, California with the wildfires, I mean, you know, a lot of displacement.
There's a lot. Unfortunately, there's a lot. There is a lot going on.
The retail environment is changing completely anyway.
Right.
All right. There's a lot of business. There's a big shift in that.
Yes, absolutely. But a lot of that is a shift in our strategy. So it's a little bit, a lot of that is a shift from what was already happening of going from your brick and mortars to your online delivery anyway. So you wonder how much, you know, maybe you'll have the Black Friday at Walmart, you know, at midnight, wherever it is these days, but they move it back every year. But, you know, the line may be shorter at Walmart, which is probably a good thing for, you know, humanity.
When you bring that up, they just advertise. Now, if you order online and pick up at the store, you get an additional discount.
Right.
Right.
So you walk in, just pick it up instead of going to the store, waiting in line.
Right. Right. They're making it easier, a lot easier to get 20.
I just wondered, because, like, three of the biggest states in the country are massive.
It would certainly have an impact. Yes, and it is pretty.
I know this quarter doesn't reflect it necessarily, but next quarter's numbers, I would imagine.
It'll be. Well, you did see, you have seen some of the monthly job numbers that were impacted, especially after Houston. We saw, at their Irma, we had an impact. So, yes, the job numbers are not so much for the last month, but again, it came under consensus, but you're seeing lower projected job increases, I think, because of that. But it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It will have an impact.
So, with unemployment down, I see, but wage data, like average wage, have not really recovered necessarily.
Right.
Like, unemployment's back down, but the wages seem to be still stagnant.
Right. That's been the story for, exactly. That was something we're going to touch on, and it's been, actually, the last couple of quarters, that's something that we've touched on, that unemployment can just come down, but wages aren't picking up. The Fed is somewhat confounded on that. You know, they want to raise rates. They want to see wages. They want to see inflation. Every time you have a positive jobs number, that's always the, that's the but at right. The wages still aren't picking up. It's a different job market that's out there. I think that's part of it. A different demographic. But some of it is really, there's a lot of, I think, confusion right now in terms of the Fed and how that's going to pick up, what they can do to pick up, and some of the policies that the administration is enacting is certainly to try to get that, those wages picking up across the country. So it's something holding back the economy right now, for sure.
It's the $64,000
question.
Right.
I'm a silver.
Yeah. And it's interesting because we talked about the Fed. Don't have to jump ahead too much, but one of the, John Taylor is one of the ones that were mentioned. And, as he was being mentioned as a candidate, again, he was a favorite at one point, and the so-called Taylor rule of John Taylor is, as unemployment comes down, wages and inflation go up. Everyone thought, okay, well, if he gets in, he's going to just immediately say, here's my formula. It was not going to be the case. Probably a little bit over. But it shows that he even admitted, he says, listen, this is a theory of mine that's to come, that's kind of exploded. But clearly what I said was, should happen has not happened in this particular case. So it's not a
flip. Well, we have some extenuating circumstances. I mean, the purchasing of, the market wasn't behaving the way
normally. Exactly, right.
And, or I think the Taylor rule would help.
Right, and I think we're getting into, as the Fed reduces the balance sheet, it seems like we're getting into somewhat of a normalized type market where these things may make a little bit more sense. John mentioned that's a big question right now, and when is that going to pick up?
My other question on the economic data would be, I see on the oil side, oil prices, which are, my question relates to renewable energies or electricity in particular. The Trump administration has a large focus on fossil fuels, but the Chinese government is heavy pushed on electric, so much so that they bought, BYD and these other big electric, companies, or they make the electric batteries, the cells, and those things, and are subsidizing heavily those companies because they want to have all of their cars electric. Of course, their car market is dwarfs the size of the U.S.'s car market. They turn their taxis electric already, and some other stuff. So, I'm just wondering do we see that we're going to keep up with their level of demand? Will weeds are spinning on the people.
Right, and we just saw in the new tax bill, which again is not the final tax bill, but, you know, kind of, you know, but they did take away some of the tax credit on some of the...
Yes, so we're on the opposite side of China, so I just wonder how that's...
It's, and you've got, you know, subsidies, the current administration looking for subsidies for the coal industry, you know.
Yeah, I mean, China went all in, thrown crazy money at the election.
Right.
Generation.
Right. It's, there's going to be some regulations, I think, go against some of the renewable energies that we have not, and I'm speaking of automobiles, you know, particularly, but there's a lot more that goes beyond that in terms of, you know, just renewable energy as a whole. It's going to be a fight because there's a lot of money, private money, that's going towards that, thinking ahead as the future. And then you've got maybe some of the public policies that are somewhat fighting against it with some, you know, coal industry, for example, some of the dying industry, that, yeah, I don't know if that's the best use of resources as we stand right now, but that's, you know, that's a lot of, that's something that would impact jobs as well. You got a lot of retraining of people that need to switch industries. So, you know, it's a hard one to answer. I still think, personally, I think, again, there's a lot of smart people that are out there that are putting money towards these resources. They're not just going to go away, but I think you need a somewhat multifaceted approach to really push that.
Yeah, well, I saw the tax credits being eliminated, and I thought, and then China announced this huge cash inflow into those same technologies, and we're trying to renegotiate a trade deal from a coal oil perspective,
right.
And they're going, what?
Right.
Those exogenous things you were talking about here that come.
Right, and I think it's not just, you know, I mentioned Tesla, every automobile industry is getting involved in electric cars, so it's not just...
Now, granted, their technology doesn't even match Tesla, you know, like the technology of BYD in China,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like, what, 180 kilometers on one charge, you know, Tesla does more than twice that,
right.
So, I mean, their technology isn't to the same level as, like, say, a Tesla,
right.
they're making a commitment monetarily to move it in that direction, and
right.
we're making a monetary commitment in the other direction, so...
We are, from a public, right, but I still think there's a lot, right,
private
a lot more that isn't going anywhere, so, but yes, it's a concern, I guess, somewhat, we'll see how that goes going forward. So I think one interesting thing is, we always talk about the U.S., but I mentioned just a little bit about global growth, and I put here just somewhat of a proxy of, you know, countries you know, across the globe. That we mentioned a lot about the U.S. has had this recovery, but we've had this somewhat slow recovery, and it's not just the U.S. Germany has been steady for quite some time. They're kind of seen as the bellwether, you know, in Europe. Japan as well, who has their own, you know, their own issues in terms of their monetary policies, but they've had very slow growth. They've done, they've dwarfed us in terms of what they've done in terms of monetary policy and quantitative easing, but they've got this, you know, somewhat slow growth, and they've got more deflationary concerns in Japan, but again, you're seeing a very similar tone in terms of how their economy is acting. I put Spain, you could also put Greece, some other more distressed European economies that we had going back to the recession, even going back, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, Greece would have a very similar, you know, as bad as things got, they have recovered. And again, their line is somewhat flattened out after a nice increase to show this slow economic growth. Even with, you know, Catalonia has been mentioned, with Spain, you know, there looks like a mess over there. I think you would think things are so bad. One of the big surprises you see when you read about that whole, you know, succession, you know, not experiment so much, but that you know, battle going on right now is that Spain is actually doing pretty well, and the economy is doing pretty well. So it's somewhat surprising that you have someone really want to leave their economy, but from, you know, The optics don't necessarily look good, but the reality is, across the globe, you have these positive economic developments. But with that said, you still have a fair share of negative yielding government bonds that are in these countries that we mentioned before. The U.S. rates, this is serving as somewhat of a ceiling on U.S. rates, because you still do have all these countries that, amazingly so, still have negative rates in some cases, a pretty high percentage of negative rates. So, of course, the question is, if you're in these countries and the U.S. is even at a, you know, 230 to 250 10-year in the U.S., that's pretty attractive when you're looking at negative rates in comparison. So that's still really, that foreign buyer, and you ask the question about where's that supply, where's that demand going to come from as the Fed pulls out, this demand still exists. And it may not, you know, going forward, but as supply comes down, this demand may, you know, stay at least, you know, status quo and continue to keep that ceiling or that cap on rates. One of the things that came out in the tax reform was the ability for repatriation. And but kind of, there was a bunch of slides that we could have went over here, but One thing to mention here is there's Apple, there's Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft. So some of the bigger technology companies are bigger companies in the world. And just how much they own in both government and corporate credit, and what kind of impact would that have if they were to repatriate those assets over here. If they begin to put that money to work, if there's further M&A, or you know, they don't necessarily have to raise as much debt going forward. So it certainly should have an impact on what the credit market is going to be. And again, that potentially takes away, if you look at these countries as governments, they'd actually be really big governments. So you know, it almost dwarfs some of the European countries, but the reality is, as that money moves around, what these companies do has a very big impact on both the government market and the credit market, the corporate credit market, especially. And I mentioned one of the risks we see right now in the portfolio and in the credit world is that risk of M&A. And as cash comes over, they have these companies have the ability to they can increase their dividend, they can do share buybacks, or they can put this tremendous amount of cash to work. And we have seen that a lot, especially in the tech space. Amazon just alone is impacting the world tremendously. Every time there's a rumor of them mentioning getting into a different market, those spreads widen out, you know, tremendously. So Whole Foods, for example, and they're in the grocery market, and then you... very cool stuff. And you're seeing some reactions to that. You're seeing Walmart, for example. I pick up my groceries at Walmart now. I don't go in the store. So you're seeing Kroger is doing something similar. So you're seeing companies that are adjusting to that. But from a creditor standpoint in your portfolio, it's not necessarily positive with this increased M&A. We just saw Broadcom possibly purchasing Qualcomm on Friday. This came out. And that was a surprise to us. We run models. We know about this risk. So we do run proprietary models to try to avoid M&A risk as much as possible. But that came as a surprise because it didn't have usually, especially in tech, you have kind of the big boys buying the smaller companies, developing them as themselves. But this was essentially two equally sized companies. Both with a lot of issues going on internally, so it was a surprise to see that rumor, so we'll see how that plays out.
Well, with the M&A risk for those guys, I mean, Amazon is avoiding those lawsuits of, you know, monopolization because their M&A is in alternative industry, whereas some of the tech giants, they are going to, you know, run into trust issues like Microsoft because they continue to buy in the same
right.
space.
Yeah, Amazon is more the Amazon is more like the Standard Oil of just getting involved in every single industry. And at some point, that someone step in and say, "Well, you can't impact everything." So, prescription drug medication as well, guys, you know,
right.
and that impacted the market. Who knows if it's going to play out? But clearly, something we try to monitor as much as we can. But there are some unforeseen risks that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting how they start to try to regulate Amazon's
footprint. Yes.
Right.
You know.
Well, Apple wants to go to
the
health care now, right?
Right. Well, yeah.
Yeah,
the
app and
your
health trackers and wearable tech. I mean, there's a...
Well, they're going to call it iDoc. Every technology could be in every single industry to some degree. So, I mean, I guess you want to have the best technology players in those industries.
I mean, in what, January is the big tech conference where they announce. So, you know, we'll see what all the new tech companies come out with. Yeah.
Right. So get your new iPhone 10s.
I got it.
One of the developments in 2017 we thought was very interesting was the correlation between the stock markets and the bond market, and it's not a typical correlation that you see. As the stock market continued to rise, the bond market, the bond prices, I should say, continued to rise as well, and rates continued to come down. And we kept saying it doesn't work this way in a normal environment. We did see very recently that start to shift a little bit, and this could be a sign of just a normalized market. But I think, as Kevin mentioned, really towards the end of the quarter, and I think as tax cuts became more of a possibility to some degree, then you saw a more normalized where the stock markets go up and then rates go up as well. That correlation started to separate somewhat, which I think is a positive in that it indicates more of a normalized market. And the reason, a lot of the reasons for that correlation in the first place was that quantitative easing, which we're now starting to step back. So this goes back towards the recession, but as you see, the Federal Reserve balance sheet in blue continuing to increase, the stock market continuing to increase as well. And that impacts corporate spreads as well in the fixed income market. So that, you know, we understood why it was happening. You didn't want to get out of it. If the train's coming through the tracks, the best thing is just hop on the train as long as you can and just know what you're doing. But now that's starting to really start to separate a little bit. you mentioned some of the balance sheet, but this is just kind of showing some of that, not just the Fed, but also the BOJ and the ECB, the Bank of England as well, all talks of starting to step off on some of their monetary policy and unwind their balance sheets. This is just some of the, we mentioned tax reform, but interesting to see in terms of how it's going to affect the deficit. There's been talks of severe tax cuts. You got to pay for them somehow, and no one really knows how it's going to happen. There could be some adjustments to that. Clearly, some deductions are going to go away, but still, it's going to require some kind of economic growth in order to pay for some of those tax cuts. And that's, I know, within the realm of politics, the dynamic scoring of economic growth and how it impacts tax cuts is somewhat of a, usually somewhat of a third rail, but it does seem like people are getting more comfortable with that idea. So we'll see how that plays out going forward. Real quickly, I was always told, a picture can tell 1,000 words, but 1,000 words or letter or numbers in this case cannot necessarily tell a picture. I broke that rule with this case with a lot of numbers on this page. But just to somewhat summarize, this goes over all the rate hikes going back to about the 1950s. And one of the, I think, misnomers in the investment community is that a Fed rate hike can cause a recession, and that's necessarily somewhat of a bearish development as rates go up. The reality is it's actually somewhat of a bullish sentiment. As they hike rates, it basically portends that there is a strong economy with the ability to withstand those rate hikes. So the reality is there shouldn't be as much fear of rate hikes in terms of them leading to a recession. If you go back historically, especially in more recent times, it's been less than a third amount of times of rate hikes where it's led to any kind of recessionary environment. Since 1982, it's been about 6%. So it doesn't necessarily, there's still risk in the environment, but rate hikes are generally a positive thing for the economy and not necessarily an indication of a recession coming. I'm sorry, touched on rates and how they did. This is just the yield curve. Kim mentioned rates were up for the quarter and somewhat of a flattening as well in the yield curve. Spreads tightened over the quarter. I mentioned some of the risks you've seen that come out this quarter, more so with M&A. From a portfolio standpoint, we've been de-risking somewhat as well. You have two choices. You can either take your amount of exposure down in the credit markets, your dollars, so to speak, or you can just upgrade in quality. And we've taken more of the stance of which is upgrade in quality. If you downgrade, if you remove too much in terms of your dollars, you're going to give up some of yield and some of carry. So you don't want to give up too much income. But we understand the risks that are out there. So we've taken steps. We've done a lot of swaps in order to increase our credit quality. So from a top-down level, it looks as if your credit exposure is about the same because your percentages is about the same. But the reality is, under the hood, it's gotten a lot safer, a lot more high quality. From a performance standpoint, for the quarter, we were pretty much flat with the benchmark. The short duration position helped as rates moved up. And our overweight helped as well. What we underperformed a little bit was it was somewhat of a risk-on environment. As we typically see when there's a strong credit, corporate credit quarter, and spreads tighten, a lot of the high beta names, energy in particular, this quarter performed very well coming off their lows. So we're not involved. I mentioned we're more in the high quality space. So we're going to somewhat underperform from an issuer standpoint. But still, the credit did help us out. We haven't switched too much. We're still a little bit short duration as we think rates are going to move up going forward. But even with that said, our yield to maturity is essentially right on top of the benchmark. So that's what I mentioned. We don't want to give up too much of that yield even as we get more high quality and safer in the portfolio. And then from a duration standpoint, we try to remain somewhat barbelled where we have a lot on the front end, especially in floaters. Give us a little bit more tactical approach, and we can adjust from that. But as rates move up and coupons move up, we expect that to be a positive performer. And then from a compliance standpoint, we are fully in compliance as well. No concerns there. And we go through this pretty much for the quarter, but just from a going forward scenario analysis standpoint, we're somewhat in line with the consensus as we believe rates are going to be moving up. We're a little bit more bearish on the front end. We think the Fed, as already mentioned, the Fed will move up in December. We think 2 to 3 times next year, same year after. So we're a little bit more certain in terms of that short end of the curve moving up. We're a little bit more uncertain on the long end. However, with the short portfolio, such as yourselves, it doesn't have much of an impact But that long end of the curve is typically more of a barometer of inflation and further economic growth, which is a little bit more uncertain, so.
That covers it for Solvex. Any questions for David? We need a motion?
Motion to approve.
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passed. Next up is Steve Alexander, CFL. Everybody's good, please.
We've heard enough.
We're enough.
One more.
All right, well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here with you today, just kind of go over some stuff. I think I would probably just get right into the portfolio. I think our two colleagues have done a really good job of giving a good overview of the market updates, so I think I'll just go, if it's okay with the committee, just kind of get right into the performance of the report. I did want to point out some new stuff in the report, so I'll get to that in a minute here. But from a portfolio standpoint, if you're able to see that, I'll probably make it bigger, but the some of the portfolio statistics would include the average credit quality is at a AA. Our duration's a little bit less than the benchmark. Benchmark about 181, we're about 179. We also did some changes to the portfolio from an asset allocation standpoint. We actually sold a number of agencies, went into more treasuries, so the portfolio sees a concentration in corporates and a little bit stronger concentration in agencies. As you heard, we've talked a little bit about de-risking, so we also went through that a little bit this quarter as well. But overall, the portfolio is maintaining, obviously, a really strong credit position. We are under the understanding that we are probably going to be faced with several rate increases next year as well. I think we've kind of been talking about today in the previous couple quarters, thinking that we might have at least three. We might have a good chance of December of this year. The meetings are, I think, 12th and 13th of this year. If the Fed does raise rates December of this year, that'd be the third December in a row. That's kind of getting to be a common hat here that December is a rate increase. But that's a very likely event that could occur. From the performance standpoint, we had a pretty good strong quarter. We're about 13 basis points above the benchmark, but more importantly, we're about 58 basis points above the benchmark for your fiscal year ending September 30th, and then the previous slices of time are also showing very positive performance numbers as well. From a cost accounting, you'll see the market value portfolio earnings was about $191,000 for the quarter. And then also the amortized basis is about $175,000. As I said earlier, and we'll see here in a minute here, the asset allocation was shifted to a little more treasuries, a little more less agencies, and then also the maturity distribution was a little bit lengthened, but not enough to affect the overall duration. We put about $6 million a little bit further, so all the maturities were kind of like 2017-18, we went to 2020-2021, still maintaining a little bit less than the benchmark duration, but also giving us a higher yielding securities. I think we picked up between 35 to 55 basis points an increase by shifting the portfolio out a little bit for that part of the maturity range, so that's the good news. And you'll see here in the distribution from quarter to quarter, you'll see that this orange area here, which is the treasuries, is picked up a little bit more. So everything else kind of about the same. So the really difference in the quarter perspective is the treasuries a little bit higher than the agencies. But you can see how the trend has been a little bit more treasuries for this time period, as we see really very little value between agencies and treasuries. They're about the same. So thing as we've talked about in over the last year or so, for the number of factors that leaves us to go ahead and buy treasuries over agencies, generally speaking, there's still opportunities. From an overall distribution, as far as mature distribution, obviously the the part that brings us the best return in this area of the yield curve is really in the 1 to 2, a little bit more on the 2-year side than the 1-year side, so closer to the full 2-year spectrum is where we're getting the better distribution. So part of the return this quarter that you saw earlier, and we've talked about how spreads have tightened simply because corporates are in bigger demand. So that helped the overall return of your portfolio, given that, you know, 36% is in corporates. And then also with rising interest rates, especially over the last 12 months, this area of the yield curve is valuable to us. And as you can see, we've got about 7% still left shorter. We want to use that in the upcoming rate increases to take advantage of higher interest rates. So we're kind of poised for that and give us that flexibility. From a credit quality distribution, obviously AA plus from S&P, 51%, and the AAAs, as well as the single A plus, are going to make up the vast majority of the portfolio. So very high quality, which is important to provide that liquidity if you're needing it. Now you can see our top 5 and top 10 distribution holders, if you will, or I should say asset holders, treasuries, Federal Home Loans, Fannie Mae, Citigroup, Freddie Mac, and Toyota are basically are the top largest positions within the portfolio. Just give me a second here to bear down to the I'm going to introduce it to the new part of the report here that you'll start seeing on a quarterly basis.
This reminds me of the old green bar paper.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Except it's not blue bar paper. And it's not paper. So given the fact that we're most likely going to have a series of rate increases, maybe to December and several next year, we wanted to add the interest rate sensitivity stress test, the interest rate sensitivity horizon analysis, and then we also have the credit quality stress test placed into this report. This will help give you a better idea of what really happens to the portfolio and give you some numbers so that you can actually see the value of the portfolio changing within a band here of either 50 basis points up or 50 basis points down. Most likely we're not going to see the downside of this, but just from a presentation standpoint, we're going to show both. We're going to have a shock test, and then we're going to have a 12-month horizon analysis done. So obviously the shock test will show you what the portfolio looks like if it happens immediately, and then we're going to say what does the portfolio look like over the next 12 months. And then we have a stress test saying that if there is a single one notch down across the portfolio, what does that do to your whole credit quality? So here's the stress test, instantaneously rate shock. This is like getting into a car accident. What happens to your heart pressure when you get hit by somebody in the rear end? And there's a 25 basis points increase, a 50 basis points increase. This is a full collision and partial collision. But you can see that the unchanged are at 55 or so, which is the current value of the portfolio. What happens to the value of the portfolio if we have a 25 basis points increase? What happens if we have 50 basis points? Most likely we're not going to have a 50 basis points. I think the Fed is pretty consistent with the 25 and very transparent. That's been going on for several Fed chairmen now. I see no reason that to change in the next new Fed chairman. So you can see the portfolio goes from 55 to 49 and from 49 to 49.6. What does that mean in the percent of the value of the portfolio on the right-hand side of this with the bars? It's a 0.5% and then almost a 4% change in the value of the portfolio. So it's not a significant amount. And keep in mind, as interest rates go higher, the material change of the rate increase starts to diminish, right? Because we're going off this historical low, and as soon as the rates went up, everything went negative. And as we have higher and higher interest rates, every rate increase will not have the same impact to the value of the portfolio. It's just that we go through this transitional period from extremely low interest rates to getting a little higher interest rates. We're going to see quarters with negative returns. We saw that in 2015, December. We saw that in 2016 quarter and was negative. There's a rate increases. But as we get higher interest rates, that value of that each rate increase will not be as powerful as the first one, basically diminishing returns from that standpoint. So there's what the shock analysis looks like. A couple things that will help us mitigate the downturn in value, of course, is duration, obviously, and then higher yielding securities will help that as well. And that's where the corporates and asset-backed providing us higher coupon will then add into what the value of the portfolio will look like. Now, most likely, with rates rising, you're not going to change the portfolio unless there's a cash need, which would be something outside of a rising interest rate. But most likely, you're going to hold on to the security. So what's going to be the value of the portfolio over the next 12 months is what this analysis looks like. Keep in mind that, as you know, the value of the portfolios comes in really two pieces. We got the value of the income, the yield income, and then, of course, the price change. And obviously, going forward, appreciation is not going to be something that's going to be in our vocabulary. As rates rise, we're going to have appreciation. And this was what the yellow showed. So if we went back in time, there would be a lot more yellow here, given the fact that rates have been declining and the bull market was basically coming to an end. You're going to see now a little bit of yellow going forward. This is what it looks like with a 25 basis points increase and a 50 basis points increase. These numbers earlier try to capture the percentage change on the total return number. And that goes back to the first couple pages where we saw what the total return was. This is going to be the percent change affecting as interest rates rise. And then down here below tries to put actual numbers to a dollar amount so you can kind of see what happens. As we go through a 25 basis points increase, you can see that the price change is about $64,000, and at 50 basis points is about $211,000. And then it's offsetted by the yield income, which should be increasing with each of these rate increases. The next one here is a stress test on the holdings. If there is a downgrade of one notch, you can see it puts us a little bit in a triple B minus. But overall, it's going to still be a pretty good quality portfolio. And then all the various footnotes and assumptions that go along with this is there for your review. So hopefully that will be helpful to you. Kind of put some numbers to it. It's easy to read, hopefully. You can see what really is the effect of a rate increase, which is what we're going to be talking about more and more in the upcoming year. Compliance standpoint, the permitted investments and asset allocations are all in compliance. Here's from the security type standpoint, and then the various issuers. Take several pages here, but all the issuers are in compliance, and as I said before, all the corporate holdings are way below the 5% requirement, so everything is, I've got a good, strong distribution of credit quality and diversification throughout the entire portfolio. And that's basically my report for you today.
Any questions for Steve? Need a motion?
Motion to accept the FM report.
I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. We have John from CAP Trust to wrap it up for us.
We'll do. Okay, this is the fixed income composite. As we've looked at it many times, you can see the total fixed income value among the managers was $184 million, which represented about 87% total. PFM is at 51.9, Sawgrass at 76, and Suggs at 56.5. The internal account measures at about $27 million, broken down between the Florida Local Government Investment Fund, the Florida Prime, SunTrust Checking. That's a total of $211.9, which is... this is the fixed income composite summary. As you can see, that during that period up in the upper left-hand corner, During the quarter, we produced net flows of about $38,000. Investment gains were $834,000. And ending value was $184,502,000. For the year, fiscal year, the total investment gains were $962.9. So, and again, with numbers as they are in this market, that's not as attractive as one would hope, but it was positive. On the right-hand side, on the investment policy, the policy hasn't changed. Again, we continue with 40% of the weighting toward the Merrill Lynch 1 to 5, and 30% to the 1 to 3, and 30% to the 1 to 10, which is the sites. For the trailing year, the account increase was 52 basis points, and again, that is net of fees. So those numbers are slightly different than the ones the managers have reported, but that's okay. They report gross. Policy would have been 38 basis points, and that gives us a difference of approximately 15 basis points in excess return over the policy. For the fiscal year, on the quarter, we had a 45 basis point return against the policy of 46. That's a difference of just negative one basis point, so I call that a wash. So we're right on target for the quarter, and again, column over year-to-date number is 15 basis points. Down toward the bottom, the lower left-hand corner, the return in up markets was 98.1%. For the year, 96.7 for the three-year period, and that's superior to the return in the down markets, which are down in the 80s. So that's positive. These graphs are a little tiny. I apologize for that. You can view them on your own after the meeting. And again, as it has been for several quarters now, the little blue triangle represents your portfolio. You'd like to see your portfolio in the upper left-hand quadrant, and for the most part, that is where we're seeing it. So you are on a risk return basis. You're beating your bogey, and you've been doing it consistently now for a very long time, since inception. This is just a graphical illustration of the returns over time, with the gold bars representing the your returns as opposed to the policy. You can see that total return again, 45 for the quarter, and each of the managers is demonstrated there. Now, one point I'd like to make is if you look down at the site's return, it doesn't have much gray shading, and the returns have been on a policy basis, or against policy, have let's call it a quantitative basis. The returns have not met the requirements of your policy. There's actually 9 requirements in there, and of that 9, if you have 5 fails, you should review the manager according to the investment policy. And I believe we have a total of 4 fails, and they're all quantitative, dealing with the last 4 quarters' performance, the one-year performance, and the three-year performance. I'm bringing that to your attention because I feel that's my responsibility to do that, and not an attempt to pick on a manager. But our analysis of it is that the manager deserves additional patience because the thesis, the story, and the actual methodology being applied seems to be consistent. Mm-hmm. And We're not suggesting that you do anything about that right now. We would suggest a hold. But again, as I said, it's close to being objectively an issue. Any questions about that?
How many additional quarters would we take a look at that?
Well, I think, I mean, honestly, if you had two more quarters of, you would start to get into probably fail another task once you hit that 5 range. One of the criteria that is more of an objective, a subjective one, is the change of ownership and management. to find that, and you correct me if I'm wrong, the management hasn't changed.
No.
The fund's consistent, but there has been changes in ownership. And so it just depends upon your interpretation of the language and the policy as to whether the ownership change is something that should be looked at more closely. But again, our thinking at this time is we're comfortable with the manager, and we're not suggesting that you need to do anything at this point. Again, this was PFM Group's returns, which I don't really feel we really need to go into because we spent a lot of time with these issues. And so with that, unless there are additional questions, I think that's all we're going to do at this time.
Okay. Any questions?
John?
Motion to approve CapTrust report.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
Motion passes.
This is our treasury investment report. Kind of piggybacks off John's report. Some of the numbers are the same. Items of note is the total value down the lower left corner, the 211,916,932. That's down about 13.1 million. And a lot of that's due to our SunTrust Bank checking account. We had a lot of impact on our cash flows during the last month. And we also had a lot of end of year payments that had to go out. You know, debt payments and went out. So everything's paid, and that's our balance right now. Of course, it will true up as we go into October. Our cash flow will return, and I expect that to be back up to 25 million plus range during this quarter. John touched on some of these, the growth in each one. Everybody had a positive growth, which is good, our three investment managers. I know SBA was down slightly. Our Florida local government was up slightly. But we expect to see those rebound also in this quarter as we start the new fiscal year. So, any questions?
John, this time of year is why I insist on 20% because cash flows significantly. Because we all start to see property taxes until December. So this is.
Right. I'm being optimistic. At the end of the first quarter, we should have an uptick in our planning stream. One thing, I want to touch on something that John mentioned. Also, I know all the contracts for our investment advisors are up within the next 3 months. We are reassessing that. Me and Bill have had some discussions along those lines, and we'll be talking with our investment committee members about that because we need to move forward on that. So. In other matters, this is our compliance with city's investment policy for our education. We were fortunate. We had Steve Alexander from PFM come up and give us 2 4-hour blocks of training for most of the people on this list. Other people had some training outside the office. And that's something we want to continue into the next year because of our schedules, and especially the city manager's schedule. And we stay on track with our education requirement. It was an excellent service provided by the PFM for that. And a hurricane kind of impacted that too. We had to go around last minute, but we got it in. Kind of nothing stuff.
I'm impacted as well.
And one thing I wanted to note on the record is I know Jim Hilty left early. And I want the minister to reflect that we thank him for his services as his last investment committee meeting. I'm going to reach out to him afterwards and talk to him about that. But he's been a member for quite a long time, and I know John's been already discussing a possible replacement from council. So. Next committee, and we'll try
to do a great job.
Mm-hmm. Any other topics? All right. Meeting adjourned.